All right. Well, with that, I'm very excited to launch into the first panel of the day. My browser will cooperate. There we go. And at this point, I will silence myself and turn things over to our moderator for today, Laura Shearing Turner. Laura is currently a PhD candidate in the Department of Music at the University of Chicago and has been working for the past 2 years as an intern for our office as well. So she knows quite a bit about this from both the scholarly angle and the career development angle. So at that, I will turn it over to Laura, who will introduce our panelists and lead our discussion. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Courtney, and thanks for everyone for joining us this morning and to our panelists for being involved in the online version. Courtney, could you reshare the... Sorry, technical issues already. Okay, sorry about that. Still trying to figure out Zoom. I'd like to introduce our four panelists for this morning. So we have Paul Durica, who is the Director of Exhibitions at the Newberry Library, holds a PhD in English Language and Literature from the University of Chicago. Andrew Leith, who is the Conservation and Collections Program Manager at the Chicago Cultural Alliance, who has an MS in Historic Preservation from the University of Texas in Austin. Anne Flannery, the head of museum archives at the Oriental Institute with a PhD in German language and literature from Johns Hopkins University. And finally, Laurie Osborne, the executive director of the Francis Willard House Museum, who holds an MA in English literature from the University of Chicago and an MA in public history from Loyola University of Chicago. So let's get straight to the questions then and find out a little bit about this rich area of cultural heritage and public history careers. So to start with, and I'm wondering if Paul can start us off with his response. Could you tell us a little bit about your current role?
So in January, I became the Director of Exhibitions at the Newberry. This is a new position, so it hasn't existed prior. Before that, I was the director of programs and exhibitions with Illinois Humanities, State Humanities Council, for about 4 years. But what I'm doing in my current position is the Newberry has three exhibitions per year that usually are drawing upon different things in the collections. And if you're unfamiliar with the Newberry, it's an independent research library here in Chicago that's been in existence since the end of the 19th century. And it really kind of focuses on the humanities. So we have strengths in medieval and early modern literature. We have a lot of Americana. We have a really large collection of materials connected to indigenous people in North and South America. But as I said, we do kind of three exhibitions per year. We also have some smaller gallery spaces that we kind of rotate materials from the collections out three times per year. And everything that we do is free and open to the public. So this is not only the exhibitions, but also any sort of programming that's connected to the exhibitions. So anyone who's 14 or older can come to the Newberry, get a reader's card, and then have access to everything that's in the place.
Thank you very much. Can we move to Laurie, please?
Hi, everyone. So I'm the director of the Francis Willard House Museum, which is a historic house museum in Evanston, Illinois. It's been a museum since 1900. So it's probably one of the oldest house museums in the country that tells the story of a woman's life, Francis with an E, not an I. So we're a women's history site. We're also the home of the Women's Christian Temperance Union headquarters and archives. So Frances Willard was the second president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was the largest organization of women in the 19th century in America, worldwide, really. And she lived until 1898, and the house became a museum after she died. So it's been nothing else but her home and a museum. It has an entirely intact collection of her family's belongings and her belongings. So I manage the house museum, and then we have a overarching organization that's the Center for Women's History and Leadership, which manages sort of the larger story we're telling beyond Willard and the story of Willard and the WCTU about women's lives in this time and the leadership of the WCTU and the leadership training that the WCTU really provided for women in this time period. So it's kind of it's a small organization. I'm part-time. It's a very, small and growing museum, though it's been around a long time. It hasn't really acted as a bigger space for quite a while. So it's just bit what I call a baby museum. So anyway, that's where I am.
Thank you very much. And over to Anne, please.
I work at the Oriental Institute, which is right on campus. It's a museum for the study of the ancient Middle East. It's also a research institute. And my current role is head of museum archives, which is the institutional archive. So anything from the many photographs that came from excavations starting in the early 20th century to maps, slides, correspondence, institutional records, and things like that. So as head of museum archives, I am in charge of a small staff that helps me catalog the archive. We have integrated the archive into the integrated database for the Oriental Institute Museum. So working with databases is part of the current role. And I also started the program, the Cultural Heritage Experiment, 2 years ago, which is an offshoot of my job as well, which is an archival lending program for undergraduates. So my current role, yes, involves anything from supporting researchers in looking at the 100 years of materials that have been collected by the Institute to helping to curate exhibits to also the daily management of the archive.
Thank you very much. And finally, over to you, Andrew.
Good morning. Thank you all for joining us for the first session of the day, bright and early at 9 a.m. So as Laura mentioned, I am the Conservation and Collections Program Manager at the Chicago Cultural Alliance. The Chicago Cultural Alliance was founded in 2008. It developed out of a series of programs at the Field Museum here in Chicago. Our mission is to connect, promote, and support centers of cultural heritage for a more vibrant and inclusive city. So we do a series of programs. We have 41 different core members. Our core members are historical societies, culturally specific organizations, many of which include museums. Our partner members are larger, non-culturally specific organizations, such as the Field Museum, the Chicago History Museum. And I believe the Newberry is one of our core members, our partner members now. So we're very excited about that. So that's a little bit about the Alliance. We offer some rich and diverse programs for our cultural heritage centers. Many are open to the public. Some of our major programs include Inherit Chicago, which takes place every other year throughout the month of October. That's an opportunity for our core members to pair, to develop different unique programs. For the past 3 or 4 years now, we have all come together, as you might suspect, over food with World Dumpling Fest, which is normally the debut to our Inherit Chicago month. That takes place in late September, early October. And that's a bit about the Alliance. So we are a small organization in that we have 3 full-time staff members, and we do a great deal of work by divide offering. So we work closely with our core member organizations to promote first voice and amplify that first voice throughout the city and suburbs. In my corner, the Conservation Collections Program, I'm really focused on working on site with core members through our Shared Collections Assistance Program, where we do different capacity building activities and trainings, We also work on scaled best practices. So we go through myriad digitization, conservation, database management, collections management, best practices, many of which are through ICOM, the International Council of Museums, or the American Alliance of Museums. And we really try to situate those to the capacity of each organization. And we try to understand their goals and their wishes for the collection and their wishes for their audience. And we try to build programs that are responsive to that. So that's a little bit about me and a little bit about the Alliance. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. So on to our second question. I think some people in the audience are going to be thinking about transferring skills from those that you learn in graduate school or in your postdoc to careers beyond the academy. So I wonder if you could each tell us a little bit about this, your transition from graduate school to your current role, and comment on whether or not your training in graduate school has helped with the transference of skills, for example. What has been useful about this movement from graduate school to your current position? So I think if we start with Laurie, that would be great. Thank you.
So my master's degree is from a number of years ago at U of C, the English literature degree. So when I was in, that was in 1985. So I took a number of years after that. I did other things, was a mom, had little kids, and then went back and finally figured out that I wanted to do public history and got the public history degree later. So my career trajectory wasn't what you would consider traditional, I guess. But I have found that the writing and critical thinking skills that I developed in both degrees, but especially in getting the master's in English literature, I use them all the time, every day. That ability to think hard and deep, and then to express that in words is very important. I would say that because I'm in public history and I do so much work with the public, and I'm always thinking in terms of telling stories that are complicated and interesting, but to a public audience, you have to learn how to translate. You can't stay in the academic language and the academic world. It's important to be able to do that kind of thinking and work, but then to almost come back out, like dive deep and come back out and then say what you mean and want people to remember in a simple and direct way. So that is really important. The public history degree was much more practical focused, much more about the different areas of public history. I worked as an archivist before I was museum director. So I spent a lot of time in the archive world, and that also is an ability to express yourself in ways that everyone can understand and connect to. So I would say the transition wasn't obvious. You know, it took some thinking. It takes, you have to be really working at it, but all those skills really do come to play. So
thank you.
Hope that answers the question.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And can we move on to Anne, please?
Sure. Even during graduate school, I think I was working sort of part-time at museums or in the library, so at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in DC. I just worked at the info desk at the library as a grad student, the Digital Research and Curation Center at Hopkins, just in a part-time capacity because it was sort of a side interest. And so I thought, why not develop that a little bit? So once I finished my degree in German literature, I actually opted to do a postdoc through the American Council of Learned Societies called the Public Humanities Fellowship, which puts humanities PhDs in non-academic positions. And that actually brought me to the Newbery Library for 2 years. And I was lucky enough to work with all the people there as the assistant director of digital initiatives, which was just a 2-year grant funded position, but it kind of got my foot in the door of working within special collections on a full-time basis, working with digital strategy, really having access to sort of understanding what an institution like that involves to run, to keep going. I was lucky enough to have Danny Green as my mentor for about a year. So it was a really big piece of the transition for me. But I also have to underscore just sort of the skills that you develop in graduate school. I mean, working in archives and special collections, especially in the humanities, you yourself have experience in archives using special collections. I also taught language to undergraduates a lot, and that is a really great skill for translating information, like Lori was saying, to a lot of different types of researchers, learners, the public. A lot of outreach is done that way. So I think those were all skills that served me very well in my current position. And that sort of experience in the digital and within a cultural institution led me to work as first a project manager on another grant for the OI, which got me into their archives, which are highly unprocessed. And once their archivist retired, I was in the unique position to be able to take that over, having had more experience in their archives specifically and with special collections than the average candidate. So that was all fortuitous, but also I think taking those 2-year positions to really get a sense of the job was very helpful. I think also working in archives, you're confronted by a lot of information that is overwhelming that you have to break down into smaller parts, and you have to think about how other people would use them or want to use them in the future. A lot of it involves sort of foresight. And as a researcher, I think writing a dissertation can be very overwhelming, and breaking things down into those parts is something you learn to do really, really well. So I think that is also a valuable skill that I learned in graduate school that has served me well.
Thank you very much. Andrew, how about you?
Thank you. So I pursued a master's in the MAPS program at UChicago back in 2010-2011, during which time, so prior to that, I worked full-time in the anthropology department at the Field Museum. My undergrad background is in anthropology with a focus on historical archaeology and museology. So I began an internship at the first museum I was working at was on campus at Loyola University in Chicago back in 2002-2003. I started working full-time immediately after graduating from undergrad in the anthropology department at Field Museum. I worked there until 2010, when I went from full-time to part-time in order to join the MAPS program at UChicago. I continued working part-time through MAPS at Field Museum, and around the end of April, while I was frantically trying to complete my coursework for MAPS, I received an email from the NAGPRA, the repatriation coordinator at Field Museum. They were about to launch a fairly large program involving repatriation of material to the Hopi, and they needed someone to assist with that. So prior to even completing my thesis, as soon as my last course was completed at UChicago, I went back to full-time at Field Museum. So that was a rather abrupt transition, and it resulted in taking much longer than I have for me to complete my thesis. I'm still grateful to the amazing support team at UChicago for assisting me and encouraging me through that. Then in 2014, I made the decision to go back to graduate school to pursue a second master's degree. This master's degree, first one at UChicago, was really focused on historical archaeology, community-engaged historical archaeology. What I will say about the community-engaged approach and how it's nurtured and informed my work at Field Museum immediately following with repatriation coordination is what I would say is that it really, it resulted in greater reflexivity on my part. It enabled me to interrogate my passive role as an outsider, as well as the broader and deeper role of major museums in the United States in the long and deep colonial past and present. And it really got me to focus on relationship building and a realization that everything programmatically, everything in terms of collections growth, really stems from one-on-one relationship development. And because of that, the first thing that, well, my LinkedIn hasn't been updated in quite some time, but the first thing, bullet point that I have as far as skill sets is I work very hard to be a good listener. And that is so important in the work that I was doing at the museum. And it's even more important in the work that I'm doing 41 different cultural heritage centers around the city. I'm very much today an invited guest in these centers. I'm not there to criticize. I'm there to understand what the goals are in-house, and I'm there to help to accomplish those goals. So in many ways, I am a technician there to try to build capacity in-house. I'll step back from that briefly. The second master's degree was in historic preservation at University of Texas Austin, 2014. The transition from that, I graduated in 2016. 2 days after graduation, I left to join US ICOMOS, which is the International Council of Monuments and Sites. I was positioned in Plymouth, Jamaica, where I was researching cultural heritage down there, working with locals who were restoring homes for folks in the community. So it was a pretty unique program. I continue every year going down there with the Grace Elizabeth Groner program based out of Lake Forest, which is a cultural heritage field school. So that was a really enriching, it was a short program. I was there summer of 2016, immediately after grad school. It took some time to find the position at Chicago Cultural Alliance. In that interim, I did everything from Uber. I was an Uber driver for a while. And these are the realities of the field, so it's important to hear this. I was an Uber driver for some time. I worked dispatch at a tow truck company. I did everything I could during that time while I was looking for a position in the field. And I also volunteered, continuing to do the work that I had been doing in the field. And historic preservation enabled me to, I would say, understand cultural landscapes. Historically, folks who work in heritage are very much siloed. Folks who work in archives are doing one thing. Folks who are restoring historic buildings are doing another thing. Urban planners are doing another thing. Archaeologists and museum professionals are doing another thing. And really, we are very much united in what we are doing, but we are divided thinking in terms of scale. So I've worked very hard to try to combine those things in the work that I'm doing at Cultural Alliance.
Thank you very much. And finally to Paul.
Okay. So I think for me, the transition began while I still wasn't in graduate school, even though I wasn't maybe cognizant of it. So I started at University of Chicago in 2005. By 2008, I was in the place to be really kind of working on writing the dissertation. And oddly enough, Lori, Francis Willard's nephew, Josiah Flint Willard, has a prominent role in my dissertation. And it in some ways connects to this story, because what I was doing, my particular project intersected with Chicago in a lot of different ways. And I was doing a lot of research at the Regenstein, up at Northwestern, also at the Newberry, which actually turned out to be a really good thing for me to do. And, you know, as I was spending all this time in these archives and looking at this material, I was coming across some things that were, you know, relevant to the academic work that I was doing, but many other things that I thought were just like interesting and kind of fascinating stories. And I was trying to think about like other people who might be interested by this material and how I could share it. And also just looking for a way to kind of like stay out in the world and stay sane. I began to kind of take some of this material around 2008 and kind of craft it into more kind of public facing experiences. So it started by doing like walking tours. I used like UChicago listservs. So that gives you an idea of the moment in which I was doing this initially and kind of reaching out to people in the kind of Hyde Park area. But oddly enough, there was an audience that seemed responsive and positive. And so that led to me doing more of these. I thought it was just gonna be a kind of one-off experience. And then beginning to kind of play around with different forms through which history can be narrated before a public. So I began doing more kind of sort of like lectures that had a kind of theatrical element to it. I eventually began to do these larger scale sort of participatory reenactments of moments from Chicago's past that really involved having to kind of form sort of partnerships and relationships with people both, you know, within the academic world, but without outside of it. And, you know, I had a good basically 5 years to kind of do this work while I was still kind of finishing the dissertation. And I think that period to kind of like test things out and to kind of build skills was really invaluable. So it was an opportunity to kind of develop a lot of the skills that the other panelists have already mentioned, some that were already, you know, in the process of being created, like gaining familiarity and comfort working within archives and kind of being able to kind of assess what's useful and what's not useful within archives, you know, strengthening critical thinking skills and writing skills, but even like storytelling skills to some degree. But then I would sort of, you know, turn to what Laurie and others have said about the importance of figuring out how to take all of this information and kind of like put it into a form that's like relevant and resonant with very kind of diverse audiences. And also going back to what Andrew said, also kind of learning how to like listen and learn from those audiences. So I think something that I gained over this time was a sense of like how expertise comes in many different forms and many different shapes, and that your own work can be really enriched by kind of like opening it up and kind of like allowing other people to engage with it and add to it as well. And lastly, I would say too, this period allowed me to kind of form relationships that were both professional and personal that I could then sort of take forward. So I began just kind of doing a lot of these projects on my own or within the university community, but over time I began to work with other cultural institutions like the Chicago History Museum or house museums like the Jane Addams House Museum or the Newberry Library. And so then when I finally did get to the end and defend my dissertation, I had these sort of relationships that were already in place and I could kind of turn to them as I was trying to figure out what to do next. And I would say, I would agree with Andrew too, it wasn't like necessarily a smooth transition. There were some gaps and some moments of stress and concern. But ultimately I ended up getting a position with Illinois Humanities, which was a really good fit and that allowed me to kind of take the skills I had developed in graduate school, but also the skills that I had developed in terms of engaging different kinds of publics and kind of work all around the state of Illinois, which was a really great experience. And then, you know, I was there for about 4 years. And Anne mentioned Danny Green. He had been at the Newberry. He'd left for a while, but he had come back to become the president of the Newberry in September of this past year. And he was somebody who I really admired and who I'd had a chance to work with in the past. And so when I learned that he was becoming the president of the Newberry, I was like, oh, maybe I should see if the Newberry will have any opportunities. And I've been very fortunate to get hired as the director of exhibitions there. But it wasn't, there wasn't any sort of plan, I guess is what I'm saying. But fortunately, through the relationships that I formed along the way, I was able to recognize the different opportunities that existed out there and then be in a position to pursue them.
Thank you, everyone. Really, really insightful, and thanks for your honesty about these trajectories. And I think as someone who's just handed in the PhD or almost about to hand in and defended, I think it's really hard to sort of imagine what life might look like beyond the graduate degree, especially for those of us who've spent a really long time doing it, which leads me to my next question. It's hard to imagine what the day-to-day work life might look like within various career paths. And I was wondering if I could ask you exactly that question and just to share some of your thoughts about that. So if we begin with Anne, that would be great. Thank you.
Sure. I guess the day-to-day work life is a little easier in some ways and harder in others. I mean, most likely you're going to have sort of a 9-to-5, which after graduate school I found to be a bit of a relief, just because when you're writing that dissertation, it feels like you never have a time off. It's just this constant thing you should be working on or are working on. And within that, it's I'm lucky enough to have a little bit of flexibility. I think you always have to remember that you have a core job, whatever that might be, which for me is basically organizing the archives and working well with the staff that I'm able to have at any one time to help me do that. So within that, I think it's important to obviously focus on the necessary responsibilities of the position you find yourself in, but to also give yourself, and when your supervisors are able to give you this as well, to give yourself projects that relate to it, but are also creative projects. Started this archival lending program, which helps undergraduates kind of live with a cultural object and see how that sort of influences their day-to-day in some ways. I was able to work on some provenance projects with the Smithsonian. And I think it's good to carve out those niches in which you remember why you love your job and are lucky to have it, because there are always the drudgery aspects, even of a job that you really, really love. So I think just the day-to-day, it's pretty standard. I mean, I think for me, I can switch from one thing to another every couple hours, which I really enjoy. It's not just sort of sitting at a desk and working on one thing all day long, whether that's a spreadsheet or a dissertation. So there is a dynamic aspect, which I think all of us on this panel have, which we really appreciate about our jobs. So it's anything from, there's a long list of things to do throughout the day. So you get to mix it up. But for me, I think the thing that grounds me in that 9-to-5 is having a core responsibility, but also projects that enhance the job and do a lot of outreach for the institute, but also sort of enhance my understanding of the core function of the job.
Thank you very much. How about you, Andrew?
I will echo Anne in that my job is rather dynamic. I do not have the type of personality where I would do well if I was clocking in at 9 and leaving at 5 and sitting at a desk the whole day. I am a very tactile person. I delight in working with objects, but even more so, I really delight in working with people. It's the constellation of amazing folks at our core member sites, whether they're full-time staff members, docents, volunteers, community stakeholders. I'm learning every single day about the different stories that have made Chicago what it is today, intimate details of family life, any kind of stories of immigration, really harrowing stories, disquieting stories, but also many amazingly uplifting stories. So it is, it's an incredible honor for me to get to be working one-on-one with folks. And what I did not anticipate when I stepped into this position was the amount of time it would take simply relationship building. The nature of the work is very much technical. It's capacity building on site at museums. It's drawing from my background at Field Museum, but also drawing from some of my scholarly research in terms of what I mentioned before about being a good listener, reflexivity, critical thinking, but really it's incredibly, I'm constantly learning and growing as a person doing this, and it's really delightful. And yeah, so the work varies considerably. There are moments when there are weeks when I'm in the office doing grant writing, where I'm working entirely independently. There are projects involving digitization where there may be core members on site that I'm training, but I'm also assisting with that process. There are moments where I'm doing preventative conservation work. I prefer for there to be a training or capacity building component to all of the work that I do. But boots on the ground reality is that many of our core members simply do not have the staff capacity to manage these programs entirely independently. So there is a great deal of independent work that I am doing on site, whether it's something as sexy as independent pest management, integrated pest management, where I'm walking around behind the scenes in storage. One of the aspects of my work that I'm most excited about sharing with core members is integrated pest management. It's really the beginning point to proper collections care. So I'm doing that. I'm working on digitization projects. So there's that independent component, but there's always a part of my day or part of my week, unless it's a week or two of grant writing, where I'm working with folks on site. And it may be preparing collections to go on to Chicago Collections Consortium's Explore Portal. It may be working with staff, training them on how to use something like a scanner or how to photograph in RAW and where to save material and how to save material. It may be working on a museum database like Past Perfects. It may be a round table with community stakeholders and staff thinking in terms of how they might be able to collaborate with folks of a different cultural background at another one of our core member sites. So there's a tremendous amount of diversity in my work, and really a really rewarding balance between independent technical work and these rich storytelling, friendship building, relationship building with folks across the city.
Apologies, I muted myself and forgot to unmute. Thank you, Andrew. Over to Paul.
Okay. So my day-to-day life, there are a lot of meetings. I'll be honest about that. There probably are at most cultural institutions. I think my position is, or I'm kind of in a unique position in that no one held it before me. So even though the Newbury has been putting on exhibitions since when it opened in the 1890s, there's never been an exhibitions department before. And as I said, I started there in January. So a lot of what I've been doing over the past couple of months have been really sort of like creating the department, working in close collaboration with the people that are there. And I think what really excites me the most about this position is it's also been an opportunity for me to learn a lot of new things. So prior to this, I had done some exhibition work, but most of my experience was with doing like public events and public programs. And so this has been a real opportunity to kind of learn new skills, and that's been exciting. And so I've been working, you know, very closely with people that I never imagined before, like facilities people and conservation, which has been really exciting. And I know all about those pest reports now because I have to review them and working with people counters. And I think what's interesting about the position is that it asks you to kind of like develop and also draw upon a real sort of varied range of skills while still getting to kind of do things that you're really passionate about. And so in some capacity, I do focus on content, which is great. And that's either functioning as the kind of lead curator on an exhibition or working with other library staff who are acting as curators. And in that capacity, I'm serving almost more like what's called like an exhibition developer, where I'm really kind of helping them think through the story that they want to tell through the exhibition, help them kind of narrow down the sort of exhibition checklist, so what will actually be in it, help them think about the different things that can supplement or support the exhibition, whether it's events or adult education classes or digital initiatives. But really, go back to what Laura was talking about earlier, it's in the past, like doing research and creating an event and then figuring out how to kind of like make it or translate it to a broader public. In my current role, I'm sort of doing that, but kind of in reverse, which is that I'm working with people who are coming from very traditional academic backgrounds, may not have a lot of experience doing kind of like public facing humanities work. And so I'm kind of working with them to take what they're doing and kind of put it in a form that can then be shared with a broader audience. And so that's been really kind of fascinating. So I would say, yes, very dynamic. Every day is slightly different. We have currently at least 6 different exhibition stages of development. And so I think the other thing too, to go just back to one's graduate experience that's been valuable on this position is learning how to manage one's time and how to structure one's time. Because when you're in graduate school, you're generally balancing a lot of different things. You might be teaching some classes, you're trying to get your dissertation done, you're trying to manage relationships with your committee and the various quirks involved there. And so all of these different things that I kind of learned when I was in graduate school, I'm still drawing upon in my day-to-day work.
Thank you very much. And finally, over to Laurie.
So for most of my career, I just really started being the director, the executive director in January too, like Paul. So for most of my working life, I was running the Evanston History Center Archives Department. I was a member of a staff. So I was managing the work of the archives, like Ann mentioned, but then also, going to staff meetings, figuring out what exhibitions we were going to do from the archival material we had, what stories we wanted to tell. And then doing a lot of work with the public. So anyone who wanted to come in and do a research topic on Evanston history would arrive on the doorstep unannounced, and I would have to figure out how to help them tell the story they wanted to tell. So I did, it was a lot of work, not of my own work, helping other people do their work. Some exhibits and things where I was telling stories, myself, but for the most part, I was helping other people. In the museum, I'm also doing that, but I have a staff, and that consists of volunteers and paid, mostly grad students who are interns or part-time docents providing tours. And then we have an archive. So there, it's a lot of management now, all of a sudden. And I have to say, I'm learning as I'm going. And even considering, like, do I need a certificate in nonprofit management now? Running budgets, managing a board, lots of little things that are about learning how to listen. So I definitely realize now how much relationships and people, so for a long time I was kind of tired of helping other people do their work. Now I'm like, oh, wow. Now it's, a whole different other set of issues and learning things I need to learn. I agree with Anne that you need to carve out some time. So I really try to carve out time where I'm getting to do some of that storytelling myself, and doing some projects that are research-based. That has been really important, even if it ends up being a little bit on my own time, for me to stay, get my brain back into reading, researching, thinking about some way, some area of storytelling that we can do with the collections we have. So I find it balance those days of helping others do their work with having something that's just mine. It really helps and it's a constant juggling act. At a museum, I mean, there's everything from making sure the toilets are running to, making sure the dead mouse in the corner gets picked up, which you freak out a little bit. It's a house, it's a small museum. So every little bit of things come, you never know what the day is going to bring. So
thank you very much, everybody. I encourage people who are in the audience to submit questions for our Q&A portion. If you have anything that you'd like to ask specific panelists or a question you'd like addressed to the whole panel in general. So please do feel free to submit some of those questions, and we'll spend maybe the last 25 minutes of the panel going through some of those. So another question from me, and we'll start with Paul. What advice do you guys have for graduate students or postdocs or people who have been in the academy for a long time, perhaps? What advice do you have for those people to enter your sorts of career areas?
Sure. So I think as I mentioned, I was very fortunate in terms of where I ended up. But I wasn't necessarily doing things in a very kind of intentional way, but I did have a good period of time to kind of like develop skills that would be later, very valuable to what I'm doing now. And so I think, and Anne talked about this a little bit in terms of what she was doing when she was in graduate school, but if you do have the time and the opportunity to begin to kind of gain some of those experiences and form some of those relationships, I mean, I think that's critical. I have a lot of colleagues who I think are trying to make similar transitions at this moment, but they really wanted to pursue and knew they wanted to be in that tenure track sort of trajectory. And then they get to the end and they can't seem to find a permanent position within their field. And then they want to try to shift to doing some sort of more kind of public humanities work. And it's a much bigger challenge to do that. So I would say really try to kind of use this time that you're in graduate school in a very sort of an intentional way to kind of be developing these skills and then developing these relationships if you feel that's a transition that appeals to you. And the other thing too is to also use this time to try to figure out the sorts of places where you can imagine yourself working. So whether you're volunteering at different places or just going to places that are doing, you know, programs and events that you really respect or putting on exhibitions that you really respect, I think kind of familiarizing yourself with that landscape and knowing what kind of opportunities exist is great. I would also suggest doing informational interviews. Most people working at different cultural institutions are very open in terms of kind of talking about the kind of work they do and also how they got there. And I think that would be valuable.
Thank you very much. How about you, Anne?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Paul. I think when you're working on something so intensely in graduate school, it's hard to think about other interests that you might have. And I forget the person who gave me this advice, it's probably many people, but just to sort of, once again, carve out some time to do something other than the graduate work, I think it really pays dividends. Just you're interested in a lot of things and just sort of tinker around a little bit, even in a very limited capacity, because it's going to set you up for later on. And through that, yeah, you develop these relationships that just sort of from that work or out of genuine interest, you just develop personal and professional relationships. And later on, they're very helpful. Maybe you'll find a job, but maybe you'll just get some really great advice later on. And so just to take care of those relationships and to really follow your interests in tangible ways. And also just, I worked with, being in digital things, you work with a lot of engineers here and there, and I just really love their idea that to not be afraid to fail. And so I think the really important thing, I found that on the tenure track, it was sort of like every step was so crucial, and then being on the job market was so very stressful, and that there's just a very different mentality in different fields, and that try something, it fails, and that's fine. I was unemployed for a little bit after my fellowship before I was a project manager, which was a 3/4 time thing for 2 years. And so it's sort of like you make things work because they make sense to you, and you're building experiences, you're building a network. None of that work is lost. So I think not being afraid if something doesn't work out perfectly, or even fails, and to know that you know how to learn. Like, you can learn on your feet. You can learn a lot of different skills. And that's a real asset.
Thank you very much. And over to Andrew, please.
Thank you. So if I was to try to pin down and classify the work that I'm doing as unorthodox as it is, and I imagine all of our work is somewhat unorthodox, it's difficult to pigeonhole any of it. My work, though, would probably fall under the umbrella of collections management. And I am so grateful and thankful to have the position that I have and be doing the work that I'm doing. I love it and I delight in it, but I also wish there was and is more transparency in academia about the realities of the number of very qualified candidates out there and the number of actual positions there are out there. There are vastly more candidates out there right now than positions, which makes it very challenging. That's the first challenge. The second challenge is the financial realities of this work. Folks within collections management, at least, are very fortunate if they're making around 40,000. Now, if you want to put that in comparison with fields, if you graduate at 22 with an undergrad degree and are interested in teaching for Chicago Public Schools, I believe the starting salary is 52,000. So there are many folks who work in my field for decades and never make that 52,000 mark. So it is challenging financially, and folks need to understand that, because we come from a wide array of different backgrounds. Some people are very fortunate to have additional support. For folks who are in my position who were not so fortunate, we need to understand what we're getting into, and we need to plan accordingly. We need to have very real conversations with our partners, if we have partners, and we need to have backup plans as well for what we might be doing while we are volunteering at an organization, while we're looking for a job that really fits within our academic skill set. What I will say is, within collections management, speaking broadly, there are two skills which I highly recommend. One is having a clear vision of what you would like ideally to be doing within the field, and have be contributing to a unique and robust CV. And I imagine all of the people who are tuned in right now have fairly unique and specialized credentials. Among those specialized credentials, it's really valuable to have certain technical skills. Having one or two technical skills within museology, within collections management, helps very much. The second thing that really helps is having flexibility and being comfortable with learning on the job and with adapting. One of the things I'll mention in terms of that, many folks that I know who have gained positions have done so through internships. I feel passionately that more internships need to be paid. Our field has a staggering lack of diversity, and I firmly believe that that would change if there were more paid internships in the field. What I'll say is, you should all feel comfortable. I believe Paul or Anne mentioned the informational interviews. By all means, if you meet someone or you hear about someone who's doing work that you're interested in, it's our responsibility to meet with you in person or chat with you over the phone or via email and be responsive. If you're interested in what we're doing, We're all eager to share the positive aspects of our work and the challenges of our work. It's not only are interested in doing this, it really is incumbent upon us to be honest with you and to share with you. So please, by all means, do reach out. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andrew. And finally, to Laurie, before we move on to the Q&A.
Yeah, I would echo what everyone has already said. Though I totally agree on the paid internships. If you're a small organization, that can be a challenge. But we do at the Willard House really try to pay our interns. That said, to get started with building some contacts and networks, volunteering while you're in grad school is a great way to get started. Lots of museums have and collections have volunteer positions. So think about something close to home. Think about something small to get started. You don't have to have the most complicated plan while you're doing a complicated thing like writing a dissertation and doing all your research. So think about what's really nearby. The collection you might be working with to write your research, maybe there's something that needs to be done right there with something you're already connected to. So start with a close circle to you and then expand out. And volunteering does count in our field, though, of course, we wish that wasn't, we wish it didn't have to be that way. Then there's the internships and building your network. Chicago is a wonderful, you can tell even just among the four of us, we have overlapping worlds and connections. And Chicago is a really supportive place for that. So get to the places that are connecting people and you'll be connected to. Build your network from that. And there's lots of different career paths too, as you've heard all four of us say. There's lots of ways to do this. So don't feel like, and like Anne said, try something else. And keep flexible. The field is a busy field doing lots of good work, but it is tough to get a full-time job, I have to say. And I've been fortunate, I haven't needed one at this stage. So I definitely feel there's room for us to build some real more stability in paying people, and though our current climate isn't likely to make that easy right now. I think that's all I have to say on that topic.
Thanks very much, everybody. And again, I want to thank you all for your honesty. And we have some in the Q&A there, people are thanking you also for your honesty and being so candid about the realities of this world, the excitement of the world, the challenges, and the sorts of skills you need. So I want to move on to a few questions we have from audience members. And in the interest of time, we need to finish promptly at 20 past 10. If each panelist could address as promptly as possible, that would be really wonderful. So our first question from the audience is, when you are hiring or have hired in the past, what skills or aspects of a resume or cover letter most draws you to a candidate? So if we begin with Laurie.
I would say one of the things I'm looking for on a written resume is really a kind of a previous commitment to doing the work. For people that are starting out, I think, in my area, there's lots of ways to get connected now. If you want to get a job in this field, you need to start getting connected. And volunteering and internships and things like that. I guess that's what I'm looking for. That may be different for much larger organizations from the other people who are on this panel. But what I'm looking for really is someone I'd like to talk to on the phone. So I do quick little short, for internships, quick little short conversations before I do. And I would say, simple thing like do what I say when I say send the application and your resume in an email to me. You would be surprised. Probably people not at UFC, but you'd be surprised how many people don't actually just do what I've asked them to do. That's a simple entry level, way of filtering people out. But when I'm talking to people on the phone, it's really about, an open, friendly person who's going to be a good team player. Everything we do is collaborative. So, that's kind of what I'm looking for as just to sort of start the conversation.
Thanks very much, Laurie. And over to Anne, please.
I think all of those are great things. I guess, being someone who's had 100 different jobs since I was 12, I always look for someone who has work experience. So just to know that you can come in, like Laurie was saying, do the job, follow directions, that's essential. You never know like what kind of job. I can see a lot of different skills that might overlap even in very simple jobs or jobs from the far past. So every year I don't get to hire a lot of people because my department is small, but I try to hire someone who actually doesn't have any archives or cultural heritage experience, but has a really good and our eloquent way of expressing their desire to gain that experience. So I think part of it is your intent as well, to show that you can do a good job, have skills, organizational skills, and really to know why you want that job and to say that you want that job, internship, whatever it might be. I know we're pressed for time, so I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. Paul.
Sorry about that. Really quickly, so I haven't had any experience at the Newberry, but at Illinois Humanities, I was involved in hiring a number of program managers. And I think what I was always kind of looking for when I would, review the resumes, so what people are saying about work experience, but also some variety in that experience. So if you're coming from an academic background, but you've had other kinds of jobs in the past, I think that's good to know. Because a lot of these positions are a mix of things. And, for some people, it's a challenge to transition to life in an office in a kind of like office culture, even if it's that office happens to be within a museum. And then in terms of the cover letter, I'm really interested in getting both a sense of people's kind of intellectual interests and pursuits, but also like what's behind that and kind of like why they get passionate and excited about this material. Because if you're going to be doing kind of public-facing work and public humanities work, you have to be able to somehow kind of convey that kind of excitement and get other people engaged. And if a cover letter can do that, then I want to kind of continue the conversation with that person.
Thank you very much. And finally, over to Andrew.
I will be as brief as possible. Everything that Laurie and Anne and Paul have said so far, I completely agree with. Having a demonstrable commitment to the field and experience, both diverse and focused, are wonderful things to have. So much of hiring is on a case-by-case basis. You are oftentimes looking for someone with certain skills. And when you're comparing resumes, if you're looking for someone who is engaging Chicago Public School students, you need someone with a pedagogical background. If you're looking for someone to do digitization, you're looking for someone with that technical background. So there is a lot of case-by-case basis. The generalities would be that demonstrable commitment to the field, and also that in-person interview, having the type of dynamic personality and being the type of person that appears to be someone who would work well with others and also someone who would be respectful of the fact that much of the work that we're doing is support work to amplify first voice. So we don't want the type of person that's going to insinuate herself or himself and speak for a community. I'm always looking for the type of person that seems eager to understand someone else's story and is there to buttress and support that person or that group of people as they attempt to share or to tell their story.
Thank you so much. Another question. I'm not going to aim at anybody in particular, but if anyone is keen to jump in who has the relevant knowledge or thoughts, the question is, it seems like non-museum institutions have increasingly been having curatorial or cultural programs. For example, the University Club is hiring curator of contemporary art collection at the Booth School, etc. Could somebody speak a little bit to your knowledge about the growth of this sort of work outside of a museum context? Andrew.
So I will, again, I'll try to be brief. Much of the research that I was doing had to do with trying to understand for myself what heritage is exactly. I think that's why when I found the position at Chicago Cultural Alliance, I realized it was such a good fit. And that has a lot to do with how individuals from culturally specific backgrounds, as well as academia, is affecting not only the field, but institutions beyond the field, thinking in terms of what heritage is. And that is that it is not this Victorian notion of idle nostalgia. It is not a connoisseurship model of old white people preserving high culture. It's very much something that is seated with the community, and it should be an empowering experience. Heritage should be a process of people coming together as a community, defining themselves, and then curating. And this is, again, this notion of curatorship, curating which places, which stories, which moments, which objects, whether they're archaeological objects, whether they're heirlooms and attics, whether they are buildings or whole cultural landscapes, need to be preserved in some capacity and need to be shared both with their children and grandchildren, but also shared with communities beyond their own. I think that that notion of heritage is inherently empowering. And I think that we are seeing more and more folks thinking in terms of what material culture is and what material culture can do as far as shaping memories and remembering. And so I think we are seeing this notion of curatorship expanding and this notion of heritage expanding its tendrils into fields that are not or were not formerly museum specific.
Thank you very much. And I think we have time for one final question. And based on the theme of the question, I think perhaps Laurie and Paul might be particularly good to answer this one. And obviously anyone else weigh in if you would like. But the question is, could you say a little bit about whether your training in writing for an academic audience has prepared you to write or construct for various, not necessarily academic publics?
I would say, I started the PhD program at University of Chicago, having come in with an MFA in creative writing. And I think having the experience that having done both kinds of writing is really invaluable for this work. I would say what's really useful about the academic experience is more the opportunity to do research and to work in archives and the opportunity to do kind of critical thinking and figure out how to kind of like use evidence and make an argument. But then when you're trying to kind of do that within, say, an exhibition context or in a public event, you really do have to kind of do that sort of act of translation. And in that point, I think storytelling and narrative become really compelling. That's how you kind of engage with the largest audiences. So I would say I think academic writing is a good, provides a good foundation and a good opportunity to develop skills that are critical to doing public humanities work. But then I think also having some experience doing other kinds of writing, even if it's like, say, journalistic writing or some kind of storytelling, that's what will really kind of help to kind of then connect that material to a broader public.
Thanks.
I think journalism is the most accessible way to look at the way you express complicated things in a simple way to a broad public. So reading good journalism can be really reading a lot of other kind of writing. Being a good reader makes for being a good writer. There's specific things that can help you, specific books and other resources in the museum field and in other fields that you should tap into, that where people have talked about how to do this well. The graduate student approach to life, when you don't know how to do something, get to the library when you can and get some books. There's lots of books written about writing well for museums. So tap into the resources that are out there already. And especially in digital history, which is new to me because of when I was a student, I've had to learn it on the fly. There's tons of good examples and they're flying all over the internet now. So you can look at what other people have done. And get up to speed. You don't have to try to invent it yourself. But I would say academic writing in and of itself is not, you need to expand out. Research and critical thinking, yes, but the writing itself that's required is really different kind of writing.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we have time for one very, very, very brief question. If all panelists could just share a snippet of wisdom before closing. It seems like lots of you have been mentioning the use of digital, very digital skills and digital humanities related things that are important in your roles and that many of you have had to sort of learn it as you go along. But I wonder if you each could share very, very briefly the importance of being digitally competent in your various career paths. So if we start with Anne.
Sure. Just very quickly, I think it's really important, and it's very difficult for someone who's interested in the material ephemera and telling stories and organizing that physical stuff to fully embrace the digital. But it is really necessary. Learning how to code, I wouldn't focus on that. I would just sort of maybe focus on digital humanities projects that you enjoy, the ton of online exhibits that are available to us right now, given our current circumstances, and just get familiar with sort of the digital landscape of museums first and foremost. And then those technical skills of the database work and creating those things can start to learn after, and also online, especially now.
Thank you. Andrew, please.
Digitization is admittedly quite important for amplifying collections and sharing with a broad audience of people. There are technical components of that, which it's very helpful to have in your dossier when you're applying for jobs. However, much of it can be learned on the job, and many of us did learn quite a bit of digitization on the job. What I would say is that I think over the past 10 years, the focus has been digitization, digitization, digitization. And at the end of the day, I think we've been a little too focused on that. This sounds heretical, but digitization is not an end product, and we can't lose track of the stories we're trying to tell and the very significant role objects play in storytelling.
Thank you. Paul?
I would echo what Andrew just said. I think it's good to have the skills and the training, but to keep in mind that like what people are really connecting with are one another and with the objects within the collection of a cultural institution. And that's a very different experience than what one has as mediated by some sort of digital tool. And even in terms of exhibitions, like not every interactive has to have a digital component to be an interactive experience. And so I think this is something that's being perhaps too emphasized in the field at the moment. And maybe we're in a unique moment right now, but I mean, maybe what people are hoping for is a much more kind of tactile and kind of personal interaction with mm-hmm. cultural institutions.
Thank you. And Laurie, for the last 10 seconds of the panel.
Well, I just wanted to quickly point out to toot our horn a little bit. The Francis Willard House did a digitized project, an exhibit called Truth Telling about Francis Willard and Ida B. Wells. We won the award from the National Council on Public History for it. So if you want to explore something that we recently did, look there. Maybe that'll be interesting for people. So thanks, everyone.
Well, thank you very much to all of our panelists. It's been a really wonderful conversation. And to audience members, our panelists have kindly shared their contact details, so feel free to reach out and use their wonderful resources and expertise. But thank you very much to everybody for showing up and to the panelists for being willing to try out this new digital format on the theme of digital. So thank you.